Welcome to Nightlights. I'm David Brent Johnson. In the late 1960s, bandleader Duke Ellington was himself in his late 60s, facing a changing musical landscape and the loss of his longtime writing partner, Billy Strayhorn. How did he respond? In the next hour, we'll hear music from albums such as And His Mother Called Him Bill, the Afro-Eurasian Eclipse, the Latin American Suite, and the New Orleans Suite, as well as the Third Sacred Concert. And I'll talk with cultural historian Michael McGurr about the significance of Ellington's final years. It's Ellington Ending, Duke Ellington 1967 through 73, coming up on this edition of Nightlights.
Thank you.
Duke Ellington with Portrait of Mahalia Jackson, featuring Norris Turney on flute from Ellington's 1970 album New Orleans. In 1967, Duke Ellington said, "People ask, when are you going to retire? Retire to what? Stagnation?" The bandleader turned 68 that year, an age when many are at least contemplating retirement, but Ellington remarked, "My band and I travel all over the world, see the sights and people. You can't beat that." Ellington sustained a pace of touring, composing, and recording that would have been the envy of an artist half his age. At the same time, in the volatile rock and roll climate of the mid to late 1960s, he was keeping his musical mind open and continuing to grow creatively. Cultural historian Michael McGurr.
Duke Ellington in 1966, on one hand, is doing what he'd always done. He's touring, still composing a good bit, still adapting, still creating, and doing it in the face of musical tastes that had changed long since. He's still in the age of rock and still adapting to that. His band, by almost any standard, was still extraordinarily good, still composed of this star set of soloists who'd been with him in some cases since the 1920s. So it was a very fine time. Some of his fans had a hard time understanding him because he adapted so much and had such Catholic tastes. I mean, at this time, he'd just made an album of tunes from Mary Poppins at Walt Disney's request, and some people could not wrap their heads around Duke Ellington making a Chim Chim Cheree, and he does it.
The most significant event in Ellington's later years came on May 31, 1967, when his longtime composing and arranging partner, Billy Strayhorn, passed away from cancer at the age of 51. Ellington was devastated, but the death of Strayhorn would prove to be a beginning as well as an ending, an emotional catalyst that launched Ellington's last great creative period.
Ellington was such a private man in so many ways, someone who, while he's always present as a performer, is nonetheless concealing himself behind this urbanity, that it's very rare in his life that you see into the depth of his feeling. One example is in the 1930s with the death of his mother. Even in the moments of his greatest successes, like when he appears at the White House, hosted by Richard Nixon in 1969, this huge moment of recognition and a kind of artistic triumph, he says, "There's nowhere else I would rather be tonight than in the arms of my mother." There's his mother, and then there's Billy Strayhorn. And again, Ellington's a band leader, which meant in some ways he's an exploitative figure. There are very few band leaders who are viewed as utterly virtuous human beings, you know. Ellington played that role. On one hand, he's somewhat exploitative. His name would go on tunes that his soloists had come up with, and his name would go on there because he'd helped on the credits because he'd helped develop them. Some people feel that he was unfair to Billy Strayhorn. And yet, Strayhorn, as he said, was my composing and arranging companion. And for a man who was so private, to call someone his companion was a very open acknowledge of a kind of intimacy. And the final thing to me is if you listen to Ellington's music, especially the album that he makes in tribute to Billy Strayhorn, and his mother called him Bill right after Strayhorn's death, his love for Billy Strayhorn is apparent, including in the most stunning moment in that album, when he plays solo on the piano Billy Strayhorn's tune Lotus Blossom. And it's not perfect. You can hear musicians in the background packing up and talking and laughing. And Ellington is playing this beautiful thing. You can hear him stumble at points. And all of it underscores the reality of it, the love he had for this man, and how bereft he felt with Strayhorn's loss. It's really extraordinary. And equally extraordinary is that he pivots from there in the last phase of his career, when he's reaching his 70s and he becomes mortally ill, nonetheless into what's arguably one of the most productive creative periods of his career. Certainly in composing terms, he does remarkable things. bearing the loss of Strayhorn. And again, the echo is of his mother. It's in the aftermath of his mother's death that he gets himself in hand, really stops drinking in the 30s and builds what many people would be consider his greatest band at the end of the 1930s and into the 40s. The same thing happens in different circumstances after Strayhorn's death.
Duke Ellington's poignant solo piano performance of Billy Strayhorn's Lotus Blossom, recorded as his band was packing up around him during the sessions for the 1967 Strayhorn tribute album, and his mother called him Bill. The following year, Ellington went into the studio with another icon who had roots in the swing era, Frank Sinatra. The album, arranged by Billy May, does not sound especially Ellingtonian, but it was still a milestone for two of America's most celebrated musical artists. Ellington also continued his global travels with a journey to Latin America, which helped inspire his Latin American suite. Michael McGurr says that Ellington's late period work reflected his times in two ways: his longstanding interest in Black identity and history, and the increasing interconnection of world cultures.
The other thing he does in the 60s is pick up on what we would now call globalization. He's one of the first American artists who fully embraces what that would mean, because he already was touring so extensively abroad and had done so since the 1930s. He's perfectly situated to do the Latin American suite, the Afro-Eurasian Eclipse, the Far East suite, which is one of his best albums that he does in the 60s. So Ellington adapts by picking two fundamental trends out of three that that can sustain him. He lets rock go, but he goes with globalization and with the exploration of blackness, both of which are rooted in what he's been all along. In that sense, unlike, oh, think of songwriters such as Hoagy Carmichael or Johnny Mercer, who really are befuddled by the transformation of music in the 1950s and 60s. And I don't mean because they were inadequate musicians, but simply the shock to them that what they did is no longer relevant. Compared to that, Ellington flourishes in the face of all these changes. He knows he's never going to be selling records on the same level that he has in the past, but he embraces the possibilities. He tries things like the Mary Poppins album, but he also embraces music that's rooted in fundamental cultural trends in the U.S. and around the world.
Duke Ellington's Brazilians from the Latin American Suite, recorded in 1968. Some of Ellington's most personally significant work in his later years went into his three sacred concerts, creative testaments to Ellington's religious beliefs. Historian Michael McGurr.
Ellington reminds me, this will strike people as funny, but Ellington reminds me of Elvis Presley a bit. You know, when Elvis Presley was really successful for RCA in the 1950s, he said to them, look, I want to make a gospel album. And their response is, you're kidding. And he says, no, I really mean it. This is the music I love the most. Ellington didn't face those kinds of constraints, but it was a long time in his career, considering he started as a band leader in, 1923. It's not until 65 that he comes out with his first sacred concert, with his first really openly religious music. It's a great success. It brings him audiences that he didn't exactly always have before. He performed these sacred concerts, often in churches, for example, where he'd not played. He clearly cared about them a great deal. They're uneven. They highlight, I think, one of his weaknesses is that he never had lyricists who were quite on the level that he needed them to be. He wrote his own words. He reminds me a lot of Giuseppe Verdi, who for many years bemoaned the lyricists that he had, and until he had Boito at the very end of his career, never had quite the librettos he wanted. Ellington is kind of like that, except he doesn't complain. And you see that in these three sacred concerts. But the best parts of them are really some of the most emotionally intense and moving music that he does.
Duke Ellington's Praise God, featuring longtime Ellingtonian Harry Carney on baritone sax, from Ellington's second sacred concert, performed and recorded in 1968. For Ellington, such convergences of the spiritual and the secular were a way of celebrating the broad spectrum of life. Another late-period extended Ellington work, the New Orleans Suite from 1970, provided a tribute to the capital city of jazz as his career neared its close. New Orleans Suite brims with a diverse set of melodic colors worthy of its subject, including the rousing second line, the groovy laid-back lyricism of Portrait of Mahalia Jackson, and the slow gospel swing of Blues for New Orleans, which puts the full power of the Ellington saxophone section on display, gives us Johnny Hodges' last saxophone solo on record, and provides a showcase for organist Wild Bill Davis. From the New Orleans suite, here's Second Line on Nightlights.
Thank you.
Duke Ellington's second line from his 1970 Atlantic album, The New Orleans Suite, which won the Grammy in 1971 for Best Jazz Performance by a Big Band. I'll have more of the late period music of Duke Ellington in just a few moments. You can listen to many previous Nightlights programs on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. Production support for Nightlights comes from Landlocked Music CDs and Vinyl, located at 202 North Walnut in Bloomington, or online at landlockedmusic.com. And from the Laughing Planet Cafe at the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington. Carry out and delivery information at 812-323-2233. I'm David Brent Johnson, and you're listening to Ellington Ending, Duke Ellington, 1967 through 73. I'm featuring music from Duke Ellington's final years on this edition of Nightlights, as well as commentary from cultural historian Michael McGurr. In the late 1960s and early 70s, honors and awards began to accrue to Ellington. Though he had infamously been denied a Pulitzer Prize in 1965, when the Pulitzer's advisory board overrode its music jury's selection of Ellington, 4 years later he was invited to the White House for a celebration of his 70th birthday, hosted by President Richard Nixon. Ellington was often wary of such recognition, however, particularly when it emphasized his past achievements. With his work-a-night, global-scale touring and ongoing composition and recording, one reason that he kept his band together, he wished very much to be seen as a vital and present-day artist.
I think that Ellington's position is much like that of a number of older musicians who are expected to play the hits or criticized for playing the hits from the past, and who, if they experiment with new things, don't necessarily get much credit for it. And some of that is because they outgrow their audiences, including critics who want them to be one thing. You know, Ellington reminds me an awful lot of Bob Dylan, or vice versa. Two men who toured long after they had to, who clearly drew energy from that. Two men who had the hits from the past and had to keep playing them to some degree, but who also engaged in an incredible range of experimentation when they were older. You know, Bob Dylan makes an album of Frank Sinatra songs. No one really saw that coming. He made a Christmas album. Truly, no one saw that coming, not even Saint Nick himself. You know, as Ellington does a Mary Poppins record. He does three sacred concerts, which is not what anyone had anticipated. He does these suites that are about the world out there, the Far East, Latin America, Afro-Eurasia. He makes record after record that no one really had expected. And so, as with Dylan, there's a funny kind of response. One is to say, well, you're no longer quite what you were before. There's also a kind of perplexity at what keeps someone going, even as there's an acknowledgement that it's amazing that these men are doing this past 70.
Thank you.
Duke Ellington's Something from the Goodellis Suite, recorded in 1971. That same year, Ellington recorded an album that many consider to be a late-period masterpiece and that counts younger modern sound artists such as DJ Spooky among its champions. Consider Ellington an early advocate of world music and take the Afro-Eurasian Eclipse as rhythmic and melodic evidence. Ellington introduces the opening number, Chinoiserie, with a rap in the old-school sense of the word that name-checks Marshall McLuhan and touts the onset of a global cultural identity. The album as a whole reflects what the late Ellington scholar Eddie Lambert noted, that Ellington's late-period work often featured exoticism that harkened back to his jungle music period of the 1920s. When it was posthumously released in 1976, critic Gary Giddens gave it high praise in the Village Voice, writing, "Just as Latin American Suite was melodic in motive, Afro-Eurasian Eclipse is about rhythm, one-chord harmonies, and chants. This one-world music reflects the ongoing jazz tradition as well. R&B, rock and roll, Albert Eiler, and Cecil Taylor are all woven into the fabric." In concert, Ellington often accompanied the performance of Chinoiserie with what has been described as a ritual dance. Music from Duke Ellington's Afro-Eurasian Eclipse on Nightlights.
This is really this Chinoiserie. Last year, about this time, we premiered a new suite titled the Afro-Eurasian Eclipse. And, of course, the title was inspired by a statement made by Mr. Marshall McLuhan of the University of Toronto. Mr. McLuhan says that the whole world is going Oriental and that no one will be able to retain his or her identity, not even the Orientals. And, of course, we travel around the world a lot, and in the last 5 or 6 years, we, too, have noticed this thing to be true. So as a result, we have done a sort of a thing, a parallel or something, and we'd like to play a little piece of it for you. In this particular segment, ladies and gentlemen, we have adjusted our perspective to that of the kangaroo and the didgeridoo. Now, this automatically throws us either down under and or out back. And from that point of view, it's most improbable that anyone will ever know exactly who is enjoying the shadow of whom. Harold Ashby has been inducted into the responsibility and the obligation of possibly scraping off a tiny bit of the charisma of his chinoiserie immediately after our piano player has completed his rikki-tikki.
Thank you.
Duke Ellington and Chinoiserie from the album Afro-Eurasian Eclipse, recorded in 1971, but not released until 1976, 2 years after Ellington's death. Ellington recorded so much in his final decade that new material continues to surface today. He also, in Michael McGurr's view, expanded and consolidated his lifelong creative ambitions.
For a man who wanted to be private in so many ways, Ellington, in his last few years, opened up much more about himself through his music. He made clear one of his most basic personal relationships with Billy Strayhorn. He made clear what he would have called his love of God. He made clear his profound belief in, his words, black beauty, in the beauty of blackness and black culture and of black people. And he also showed how much he truly was himself beyond category in his openness to the idea that music is a global thing, that the world is made up of a whole range of global cultures, all of which any musician should be free to embrace. In that sense, in his last years, he's most profoundly himself. He doesn't remake himself. It's new music. But all of those things are rooted in who he was throughout his adult life.
In these final years, Ellington lost many of the musicians who had been with him for decades, such as saxophonist Johnny Hodges and trumpeter Cootie Williams, either to retirement or death. Still, he soldiered on, touring the Soviet Union in 1972 and publishing an autobiography, Music Is My Mistress, in 1973. That same year, however, Ellington was diagnosed with lung cancer, and though he kept up his work pace as much as possible, by early 1974 he entered a hospital as his health declined irreversibly. Even as he lay dying that spring, he continued to work on new compositions, the orchestral work Three Black Kings, and music for a jazz opera called Queenie Pie. On May 24th, only recently turned 75, he finally succumbed to the cancer that had been ravaging his body. In his eulogy at Ellington's funeral, critic and Ellington champion Stanley Dance said, "His records are the greatest of his gifts to us. Here one can enter a unique world filled with his dreams, emotions, fantasies, and fascinating harmonies. He brought out qualities in his musicians they did not always know they possessed. He had the knack of making good musicians sound great, and great musicians sound the greatest. As the best arranger in the business, he was able to furnish them with superb backgrounds, and as one of the most inventive and underrated of pianists, he gave them inspiring accompaniment. He was, in fact, more of an inspiration than an influence, and though he made no claim to being a disciplinarian, he ruled his realm with wisdom." Just a few months before his death, Ellington, visibly and audibly exhausted, had presented his third sacred concert, a work generally considered uneven, but with several high points that show that even in the ever-growing shadows of mortality, this maestro of music beyond category could still summon greatness.
The last sacred concert, which he does knowing that he's dying, his band is decaying, members of his band are dying or leaving. He's down really to two musicians whom he really trusts. One of them is the baritone saxophone player Harry Carney, who had a sound like nobody else, and the Swedish singer Alice Babs, whom he'd gotten to know late in his life. And those two musicians drive this thing. Alice Babs singing My Love, about love of God, is just profound. And then the cavernous sound of Harry Carney drives the rest of this, again, very uneven night.
Thank you. indescribable. The power of God is unappraisable. The sight of God is unimaginable. And one should know that the light of God is truth and does not a shadow throw.
Close with Duke Ellington in 1973 performing The Majesty of God from the Third Sacred Concert. Thanks for tuning into this edition of Nightlights. Special thanks to Michael McGurr. You can listen to many previous Nightlights programs on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. Production support for Nightlights comes from Landlocked Music CDs and vinyl online at landlockedmusic.com and from the Laughing Planet Cafe at the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington, Indiana. Nightlights is a production of WFIU and part of the educational mission of Indiana University. I'm David Brent Johnson, wishing you good.